In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We hear the second part of the interview with Rick Keefe. In the second part, we'll hear more about the interference Rick has experienced as a longtime UFO researcher. He will also go into more detail about the attacks against the late former U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens and his untimely passing, a peripheral element often overlooked when learning about the Aztec UFO incident is the armada of UFOs witnessed by thousands over the nearby town of Farmington, New Mexico. Rick will connect this mass sighting with a critical counter-intuition about a possible Trojan horse setup regarding the Aztec New Mexico UFO crash. The implications of an alien species knowingly setting up humanity to secretly have them integrate their alien technology into society is an eye-opener. Past guest Miriam Heinen gave an example. She pointed out how researcher Josh Reed suspects that Dr. Charles Lieber, known to have special access clearance, may have been working with reverse-engineered alien technology while at Wuhan Virology Lab in China to develop nanosensors that attach to human organs in the body, receiving and transmitting data. Is this a building block for a smart city prototype? Is this dystopia foreshadowed in the 2010 film Repo Man, when artificial organs can be bought on credit? This UFO recovery event in March 1948 was one of several during that time period. However, this craft landed intact. Yet, who knows how many more intact recoveries occurred that weren't publicly witnessed? Why are these potential origins of technical evolution important? Well, our society has been reshaped by technology. Our minds have already been rewired after decades of internet access. As our guest Rick explains, is it possible an advanced race allowed humans to access a technology? However, for the non-humans, it's an outdated technology. So it can be remotely manipulated to then influence the direction of civilization, maybe a spiritual redirection. Last year, testimony was heard at a House Oversight and Accountability Subcommittee from individuals alluding to a concern regarding the unmonitored use of what was back-engineered. It's unclear how much of this technology is integrated into human society. What is clear is the development of anti-gravitic propulsion systems into a zero-point energy source to flourish in society didn't quite take off. Or did it? One theory many freethinkers have suspected for years is zero-point energy power plants have been built and are currently powering cities worldwide under the guise of using outdated power sources such as coal. Rick Keefe joins us for a second hour. He is a longtime UFO researcher, a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and blog author. He lives in Arizona with his wife. Rick has amassed some of the most in-depth and intriguing interviews of alien contactees, abductees, UFO eyewitnesses, and military insiders. His high-quality documentary film work, articles, and blog can be found at UFOHypotheses.com. Well, Rick, one theory I've recently heard from researcher Josh Reed is that these crash events could be a Trojan horse causing humans to integrate technology with theirs. And I know you've referenced this in our previous interview and your answers in previous answers. Can you give us a little more detail here on your thoughts on that concept?
Yeah. So the researcher, Josh Reed, who you're referring to, I think he may be right about that. I've not read his work or seen his material, but he may be right. If you guide a less technological civilization that you encounter by giving them inferior technology that you used generations ago, and you lead this less technical civilization on a path to develop more sophisticated technology than they have, but that is also far inferior to the technology that you now possess, then you can control that other civilization, because your civilization maintains the superior technology with all of its military and strategic advantages. And this parallels how the U.S. Air Force has sold off many of its inferior fighter planes, something that Wendell was involved in, like in Bolivia, for instance, to other countries like in South America since the 1950s, where the U.S. sold off its inferior fighter planes. Those countries had no Air Force fighter planes at all, so for them it was a huge technological leap. But the U.S. still maintained air superiority over all those countries whom were customers of our used, outdated airplanes. So you can see the parallel there. So I think here's a good spot to talk about more about the Farmington flyover, because I think it relates to the why aspect of a Trojan horse theory. The Farmington flyover occurred just 2 years later than Aztec in 1950, same month, March, same part of the country, even same part of New Mexico in its very upper northwest corner. Here we go. Here's the Farmington flyover. Aside from the original reports in the Farmington Daily News in March 1950, there have been at least three thorough investigations of the three-day flyover of wave after wave of flying disc spacecraft, that is the Farmington flyover, that I know about. And those three investigations were conducted by Frank Scully in 1950, Linda Moulton Howe in 2002, and Norio Hayakawa in 2006-2007. So in 1950, just a day after oil millionaire Silas Newton made his March 15th speech at the University of Denver, revealing to the audience that the Air Force was covering up a downed flying disc they had captured near Aztec, 27 miles to the west in Farmington from Aztec, a shocking, magnificent event occurred. And first I will quote from Frank Scully's book, Behind the Flying Saucers. Quote, the sky had been cluttered with flying saucers for 3 days, but on St. Patrick's Day in the morning, half the town reported saucers in the sky. Some saw hundreds. Quote, on the morning of March 18th, the Farmington Daily News ran an 8-column banner headline proclaiming huge saucer armada jolts Farmington. It was reporting the news as the entire staff and most of the town's population saw it. Close quote. So Clayton J. Boddy, the paper's business manager and a former captain of engineers in the American Army in Italy, was also a witness to the flyover events. So he was the paper's Farmington Daily News' business manager. And they also had another staffer, Orville Ricketts, the associate editor, who also had a hand in the publishing of this day's newspaper and that headline. And the story itself was written by Walter Rogel, the managing editor. All this comes from Scully's book, Behind the Flying Saucers. And if you can find a copy, good for you, because I think that's very important. Even though it's considered discredited reading, read it and make up your own mind with all this other information at your disposal now. The main story reported that over 2,000 people, half the town's population, was, quote, still certain the morning after that it had seen spaceships, hundreds of them, zooming through the skies on the previous day. The estimates ran to more than 500 spacecraft. The objects appeared to play tag in the sky. At times, they streaked away at almost unbelievable speeds, estimated at 1,000 miles an hour, and guessed the silvery disks were about twice the size of a B-29. John Eaton, Edward Brooks, who had been a B-29 tail gunner, and John Bloomfield testified that it was all true. Bloomfield estimated that the waves of disks traveled at 10 times the speed of jet aircraft and would stop and make sharp right-angle turns. Captain of Engineers in the American Army in Italy, Clayton J. Boddy, was also a witness, and he's mentioned above. Joseph and Francis Kalilov, who owned a grocery store chain, reported that the spacecraft were flying in formation. Harold F. Thatcher, Farmington's director of the U.S. Soil Conservation Service, who had engineers working under him, also testified in agreement. Strangely, no one reported hearing any engine noise or seeing any vapor trails. Eyewitness Marlow Webb, a U.S. Navy pilot in World War II, testified that from the ground they appeared about the size of a dinner plate. They flew sideways, on edge, and at every conceivable angle. This is what it made it easy to determine that they were saucer-shaped. The Las Vegas Daily Optic reported the event with an 8-column banner headline also, "Spaceships Cause Sensation." So your listeners may wonder why this case is not more commonly known and discussed in the free press as, say, Roswell is. Well, that's because 2,000 plus witnesses are extremely hard to deny. So instead, they were all ignored and purposely forgotten by major U.S. corporate media owned by the oligarchs. In 2002, famed ufologist Linda Moulton Howe gathered additional information on the three-day event from March 15th to 17th, 1950, by re-interviewing Marlow Webb, then 78 years old and owner of a Chevrolet dealership in Farmington at the time of Howe's interview. Among the details Webb told Howe were, quote, "I saw shiny objects, anywhere from a dozen to a dozen and a half, making erratic course changes. Normal aircraft would have made a curving course change where these seemed to be darting about at very sharp angles." Howe also re-interviewed Clayton J. Boddy, formerly of the Farmington Daily Times, that broke the Farmington flyover story to the world. Boddy said, quote, "They were silver-like disks going through the air end over end, and they were following in a compact group. There must have been 100 or so. We were standing there talking, and all of a sudden we looked up in the sky to the west, and we saw these objects flying around. They were flying quite rapidly, and they were just moving back and forth. I was in the Navy Air Corps. They were moving rapidly and in erratic areas and directions, going different directions, and they were all more or less together. They were kind of a flat shape. They all moved sort of together when they moved back and forth across the sky. They moved out fast, just a zoom. We were all shocked, and I just knew it wasn't anything that we had that would maneuver like that." Linda Moulton Howe reprinted the whole text of the original article on her website, earthfiles.com, and it may still be available to those interested listeners. There are also articles about the event posted on the internet and photographs of the front page and headlines. The full article also included a timeline of events. Notation number 2 reads, 10 a.m., reports of hundreds seen west of town. Notation 7 reads, 3 p.m., fleet of hundreds seen flying in formation to the southwest from the northeast. So now the Aztec City Library, they have retained the information gathered on this event and information gathered from numerous conventions held there over the years where UFO investigators gathered annually with townspeople and interested visitors. Former Air Force Captain Edward Ruppelt and head of Project Blue Book wrote about the event in his 1956 book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. Quote, "Estimates of the number varied from a conservative 500 to thousands. Most of the observers said the UFOs were saucer-shaped, traveled at almost unbelievable speed and didn't seem to have any set flight paths. When Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens, my wife, and I attended the Aztec Library UFO Symposium event together in 2007, I met Norio Hayakawa again, and Norio shared with me for about an hour details about his recent investigations in nearby Farmington about the flyover. So Hayakawa assembled a lot of material about this event too. Norio is 80 years old now. He's still actively investigating UFOs. His website is still active. I saw him have posted something here in February of this year. And he may be a great candidate for you to interview, Jeff.
Okay, thanks for the heads up there. Appreciate it.
Sure. So I believe Aztec was like trapping a mouse in a maze with the lure of super high tech as the cheese. It is possible that by 1950, based on early agreements made with U.S. leaders, an ET group flew their ships by estimated treaty over Farmington in the Four Corners area of the Southwest United States and established bases underground, connected by several tunnels, of which one leads to Dulce, New Mexico, in which humans like Phil Schneider were later engaged in a firefight against certain extraterrestrials several decades later after Aztec, as Schneider has testified to before his, let's just say it what it was, his murder. Furthermore, numerous researchers like Paul Blake Smith have gathered evidence that suggests that negotiations were likely made between the Eisenhower administration and a group of extraterrestrials who may have had a sinister agenda here for Earth humanity. So I'm speculating that a malevolent group of ETs have actively been carrying out their agenda for Earth, abetted by a multitude of traitors to humanity and self-serving Earth leaders of industry, the military, and governments ever since. And I should add that there are also many malevolent extraterrestrial groups opposing those negative ETs and their malevolent agendas. And these benevolent protective ETs have been helping humanity overcome the negative groups' agendas, even shutting down nuclear missile silos when necessary. So the Trojan horse aspect of that is simply, if there happens to be in the universe a group of extraterrestrials, and this group has been involved in Earth for eons of time and wants to continue to maintain some influence over this planet and its population, that they could design traps to keep retaining a certain level of control over the population. And that there also may be other groups in the universe that are benevolent, also interacting with Earth, that have an opposing agenda, which is to uplift humanity in all aspects and to help free them from this hostile control of this other group without destroying the planet and without destroying humanity. Now, that would be quite a predicament to be in if you were the benevolent ETs.
I agree, Rick. I was just thinking, and it could be a typical mission, right? This could be a garden variety transition point for civilization. Okay, Operation Protect and Release for humans or something like that.
Yeah, I just think that it would be very egotistical to think that we're the only species of sentient life in the universe. I think it would be highly unlikely for the universe to be designed like that. I think the universe is extremely much older than the Earth itself, and that therefore there are likely to be life forms throughout the universe. I think some of them may have discovered our solar system and been involved in our solar system. And I think that some of them have actually been involved in the genetics on this planet with animals and humans, and that some of them are at cross purposes. Some of them are self-serving and some of them are service to others. I've also got another idea here popping in mind, and that is, so one of Wendell's other cases was the Bill Herman case, and that was in Charleston. Those beings were described, that was also, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong because I'm just going by memory here and I haven't reviewed this material for over 15 years. But what I'm remembering is that they were short and very intellectual. So maybe there were some of these beings, I think it was, they were part or said to be part of Zeta Reticuli. Now, I know that's a big constellation and there's all sorts of planets and, you know, so when you say something like they were from the constellation Zeta Reticuli, that does not denote any other species who may have been mentioned in any researchers' reports about Zeta Reticuli, just this specific case. But maybe that's worth cross-referencing because maybe those descriptions could fit that race. But anyway, that's just an aside.
Yeah. Well, that also gives listeners where we might be going in future interviews because listeners, Rick has gone literally into outer space with his research and information. So let's get into this other question here. Rick, I've been reading William Steinman's book, UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret, co-authored by retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens. As many know, it's among the first very detailed account of the crash and subsequent cover-up. Rick, you've been interviewing the book's co-author, Wendell Stevens, for many years and became good friends with him. However, please tell listeners about Bill Steinman and threats against his continued research.
Sure. And let me just add here that Wendell Stevens passed away in 2010, in September 2010. So I have not interviewed him, obviously, since just prior to his death. But yes, let's talk about Steinman here. And I'm going to use some of Wendell's own words here to talk about Steinman. I have something that I'm going to share with your audience in Stevens' own words. So at this point, I'm going to read three pages from Wendell's speech on March 27th, 1999, at the Aztec UFO 1999 Symposium, giving you an idea about the level of interference they faced in getting the book UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret, published. And then afterward, I will share what Wendell told me on videotape in a private interview. So here's Wendell Stevens speaking at Aztec Symposium on March 27th, 1999. I am here in the place of William Steinman, who was invited earlier. They tried to get him to come last year, and he didn't make it, and they tried to get him to come this year, but he didn't. They finally got him to call in, but he wouldn't tell where he was or give return telephone numbers and declined to come again this year, and I'll tell you why. First of all, there was a lot of interference in putting the book out. I had previous experience with manuscripts being taken out of the mill, so I knew that this happens and I knew that this was a sensitive subject. I had telephone calls about it warning me not to proceed, not to go any further with it. I ignored them. Nothing has ever happened to me. Bill Steinman has been turned down by William Moore, and he has come to me, and I have agreed to type the material up and submit it for him. We have it in final form with camera-ready copy, and I've sent out dummy packages. Now, this is trying to get the book published. I have sent out dummy packages to three printers to see if they would go through it because I have had it taken out of the mill before. In this case, none of the dummies arrived at their destination. So I knew that the postal system wouldn't work. Somebody is taking them out of the postal system. Next, I went to UPS and I prepared another dummy package and mailed it to one of the printers. They record every movement, every time the package gets loaded or unloaded, it gets checked. UPS loaded it onto one truck, and it didn't come off that truck at its final destination for it to be broken down and distributed. They lost it someplace in between and couldn't account for it. They started an internal search and to this day have not found what happened to that package. It just disappeared into thin air, and that's 14 years later there, or so. We then tried Greyhound parcel service. You can send anything through the bus. This time, we waited until just enough time to turn the package in before the bus left so that we could see what was happening to it. We stayed there until it was processed and loaded onto an outgoing bus. That package arrived. So I made one more attempt. I tried the mail again, and this time I used Priority Mail and sent another dummy package to my friend Leo in Arizona. It only goes through one breakdown in Phoenix between Tucson to Pine Top. That package, to this day, has never arrived. So now I realize that I'm being watched and I haven't produced the original camera-ready copy yet, which I didn't even hold. And I was putting it together with all the interference I had in doing this. I decided it was not safe to keep it at home. As a matter of fact, my home had been entered so many times while I was working on it that the agency broke their key off in my door one time, and I had to get a locksmith to come and change the lock. It only took them one trip to get new keys to fit my doors. They were very careful. They didn't take money that I left out to tempt them. They didn't take anything but material pertaining to the chapters that I was writing and materials on the case right here. Those two cases, they did take original photographs out of my files from the case, and they took some of the personal messages and notes that William Herman had written me on his own hand. And I had mentioned that earlier, that case, to you, Jeff. I don't know what they took those for. I knew I was being watched. I also discovered that I had a radio pickup over my dining table. They could listen to anything said around the dining table, and knowing that was there, I was suspected there were others. Before we discovered that one over the dining table, my phones were swept by an expert company, and they found a bug in the phone. And they removed it. It was an AT&T device that was inserted into the handheld part of my telephone. We took it out, and the agency which took it out took it with them. They got approached by a government agency warning that they were interfering with intelligence matters and that they could be prosecuted for such activity. They were forced to give the device back. After that was taken out of my phone, we still were getting clues that my conversations were being listened to, and I would get feedback from them. I called them down again, and this time they found the bug not in my house, not in the telephone, but out in that little box out in the street in the alley behind the house. The tap was there, so we removed that one. This time, we took it directly to AT&T and said, "You've lost something in the box out here behind my house. It's got your numbers on it, and we want you to have it." It was a short time after that, I was sitting out on my back porch, and I leaned back in my chair and looked up. One of those ventilator panels on the side of my house under the eaves with the holes in it had been removed and put back, but it wasn't put back exactly in the same place, and there were some white lines where the paint had been broken by the removal and reinstallation. So I called my friend down again and his detector, and he found there was field-powered unit about the size of a cigarette laying alongside the power line to the line over my dining table. Every time that light is turned on, there is an active microphone up there. So we decided to leave it there and use it to our advantage. At that point, I'm sure there were others in my house, so we never discussed anything like this in my house, always elsewhere. It was about around this time I became concerned about what was happening to the camera-ready copy that I had typed up. I took it to Bob. Bob was a deputy sheriff of the county. At that time, he was a retired senior master sergeant. He came to Tucson and he went to work for the sheriff's department and rose in rank. I'm going to break out of the Wendell's speech here and tell you that that was Sergeant Major Bob Dean, that was a longtime associate and friend of Wendell's. So back to what Wendell was speaking about. He was a rather high-ranking deputy by this time. He would come to my house in this deputy police car, and we would discuss UFO things. He never allowed any of this discussion publicly because of his position, but he was also the senior board member of Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization. They had five board members, and he was the senior one. Let me grab some water here real quick. So, I could talk with him because of his position in that role. I didn't get along too well with a certain member of ABRO because she had an abrasive personality and she was an alcoholic. However, I was given the keys to the office and he said I could let myself in. I would go down there and read the foreign UFO magazines since I didn't have any of my own and they had a pretty good file. I was keeping Bob updated on what I was doing most of the time, but I wouldn't tell because she always argued about everything. We couldn't get the camera-ready manuscript to a printer. We tried to figure out what our next step could be. I had been discussing this experience with Bob all along. So Bob was holding the final manuscript, the camera-ready copy, in his possession. I didn't even know where he had it, so that if someone tried to listen to what I was saying, I wouldn't slip and give it away. About this time, Bob got a call from an old Army buddy who had been transferred to the Air Force, gone through pilot training, and had become a fighter pilot. He was flying from some base in Los Angeles across country, getting his cross-country training flight. All pilots were required to get a minimum of 4 hours of flight per month to keep their flying status current. They usually are encouraged to take this on cross countries because they go through a lot of the normal procedures. So this guy had landed, called Bob, and said he was in town and would like to get together with him and discuss old times. He suggested they meet at the restaurant at the Tucson airport. So they did and had lunch. As they were breaking and getting ready to leave, the pilot pushed back his chair and stood up and said, "Look, if there's anything I can ever do for you, just let me know." Bob said, Did you say you were going to Detroit? Now I'm trying to get the manuscript to Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's the real destination for it, and I can't get it there because all the dummies have gone another direction. So the guy said, yeah. Bob said, could you contrive a fuel stop at Ann Arbor for me and drop a package? He said, well, I don't know why not. So Bob said, come on with me. It's all ready, and I want you to take it in an address I'll give you. Just land at Ann Arbor and take a taxi. I'll give you money for it. Take it to this address and give it to this man and be on your way and I'll be happy. So after all the interference by government and government agencies, government actually delivered the package to the printer in Ann Arbor, Michigan in an Air Force fighter jet airplane. Okay, so that's the three pages. So in private interviews with me, Jeff, Wendell told me that Steinman did not understand the risks he was taking by investigating the Aztec case. After the book was released, after a little over half a year, an FBI agent in Los Angeles called Steinman where he worked. The FBI agent told Steinman they had arrested a petty criminal, and upon searching the criminal's residence, the FBI had found photos of Steinman, his wife, and children, Steinman's house, maps of the routes Steinman took to and from his job, routes to the school and back where he and his wife picked up their children, routes to their grocery store. After FBI questioning, the criminal admitted that he had accepted money to assassinate Steinman. The FBI agent claimed that this criminal was given the maximum sentence for his petty crimes, but that since he had not yet attempted the assassination, they could not charge him for that. Stevens told me that when Steinman told his wife that she went wild and insisted they sell their home and that Steinman quit his job and that they relocate to another state, which they did. Steinman's wife was alerted again to something in their new home, and Stevens said that Steinman and his family moved again a second time, and Steinman then retired from ufology. So, yeah.
Wow. Rick, I don't think very many people know about this level of interference. And this is just getting that book out, UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret, published, I do believe, in 1982. Unbelievable. We take so much for granted, these books, this information, but a lot of harassment, sweat, equity, hair loss from the the worry, you name it.
I'm blaming mine on genetics.
Okay, fair enough. Please tell listeners a bit more about Wendell Stevens and his prolific writings.
Okay, so I interviewed Wendell over the course of 2004 to 2010. Wendell passed away in September 2010, but there is far too much to tell about Wendell. While Wendell was alive, I interviewed him for about 100 hours, and I will eventually publish his biography, and from time to time, I release more hours of those interviews. But Wendell is a subject in himself that could take 12 hours, one-hour shows, or 20 one-hour shows. It's too much.
Absolutely. Do you have a prospective date for that biography to come out?
No, because what happened was after 2010, after Wendell passed, and some other events occurred, which I'll share with you here. I had become in contact with beings who told me that I had a gift for healing, and I was getting more and more difficulties pursuing my investigations with UFOs, and I decided I don't need that hassle, and I would like to pursue this gift of healing that these beings have told me that I have. And that, so then I did kind of a change of course and followed that for the next decade of my life.
Oh, that's
so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got massive amounts of material. I mean, I could do a show every month for the next 5 years. Let's put it that way.
Good to know, though. Very, very good to know. Now, in 2013, Rick, a documentary titled Mirage Men premiered, and watching it recently for the first time, you are inadvertently on camera interviewing someone at a UFO conference. You're no stranger to this type of complex harassment and surveillance the film portrays. Please tell listeners about the surveillance you've experienced and how the UFO crash near Aztec, New Mexico, initiated a more aggressive program monitoring civilians throughout their lives.
Okay, sure. So, yeah. So Wendell was surveilled his entire post-Air Force civilian life, which was starting in about 1962-63 forward. Always surveilled. And my family had numerous periods of strange phone incidents starting after I began interviewing Wendell about his lifetime for his biography. I've met harassment at UFO conventions by military intelligence types, suggesting that I stop making my documentaries because it was dangerous to do so. Specifically, I was intimidated at the 2008 International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, by someone I believe to be a government spook. In 2009, Wendell was in great health. He went to the Presidio, received some injections there, presumably for his health, and died from them a year later, in September 2010. In 2011, Elaine Douglas, a journalist who worked with John Carpenter of JAR, the Journal of Abduction and Counter Research, was certain that she had been given a disease by the government, and she contacted me and had seen a 6.5-hour documentary series that I produced on the S4 laboratory within Area 51, and she felt that she wanted to investigate my investigation, so she re-interviewed everybody associated that was in my documentary that she could, and she agreed that my documentary was truthful. and then she died shortly after producing that essay. Her report is available in full on my website. I don't know if John Carpenter's still around of JAR. I think he was in Missouri, but he might be, you know, definitely worthy of interview if you wanted to talk to him about Elaine Douglas. Then in November 2009, my wife and I interviewed John Lear at his home. He's the son of the inventor of Learjet, and he was an expert on many areas. He is famous for his interview with George Knapp, and where he brought out, you know, this very shocking at the time information about certain alien species. And so we interviewed him all day about his life and his investigations. We got about 8 hours of video and two different cameras, which I've never released, because later, as we were driving back to the hotel where there was a Congress going on, and we're going to interview Dr. Michael Sella, which we did that evening, there was a black SUV that, okay, so there was a lot of construction on the Las Vegas highway at the time, and I was staying in the right lane so that I could get off at my proper exit to get to the hotel. And there were these poles, these orange poles, all along the right side of the highway. And darting out from within one of those poles was a black SUV right into my lane, just enough that I would have to swerve, which I did, and to cause me to be involved in a rollover car accident. And somehow, like, I was able to left turn and right turn without flipping the car over, and I got the message, what they were doing there. And so those two deaths, Wendell and Elaine, so close to the near accident in Las Vegas, it all happened within about a year's time. And I decided, you know what? I don't really need this in my life. I've shared so much that people already, that people are going to have to chew on for years and years, and let other investigators pursue for a while. I'm going to give my family a break and myself a break, and I'm going to go pursue. Okay, so I was in contact with beings that told me I had a gift for healing. I'm going to go pursue that. I'm going to pursue healing. And that's what I did from 2010 to 2020. When in 2020, COVID came up and I started, you know, sharing with the world on Facebook and all sorts of different venues, you know, don't take this vaccine, you know, be careful. There might be some nanotechnology in there that you're going to inject, other side effects. It's not been tested long enough. And so in 2020, everybody decided they weren't interested in getting in close contact. And so my healing stuff kind of stopped for a few years. I've since started doing that again after people's paranoia over COVID has gone away. But so there's a lot of stuff to talk about, Jeff. A lot of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you're okay, Rick. And yes, those suspicious deaths, the two that you mentioned, Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens and Elaine, the journalist, the documentary filmmaker. Yeah, it's very suspicious.
Well, I'll tell you, Wendell was 87 or so when he passed. So people would say there's nothing suspicious at all. I say, because I was with Wendell in 2007 at Aztec, and I was with him all those years up to his death. I even did a show with him in a public access show called Cosmic Chronicles 3 months before his death. But a year before he left to the Presidio, he was in great health. At 86, his diet was excellent. He was very fit. He could walk really fast. He was fine. And after he got back, his lungs were affected almost immediately. He started coming down with these pulmonary issues, and it just got worse and worse. And he lasted another year, got all his affairs in order, I helped encourage him to place his collection of photographs and materials. And he found a place called Open Minds, in which he transacted moving all his materials to Open Minds. And then he passed away a few months after that public access show. Passed away, I think it was September 7th, 2010, and I've missed him ever since. He was a, you know, he was a controversial figure. There were things about Wendell's life that are very difficult to explain and talk about, especially like his years in prison. But all that was covered in the interviews that we did. So Wendell will have his say one day. He will have his voice heard, and whether it's true or not, whether he's conveyed everything to me truthfully, I feel that he probably did. But it was one of the most interesting associations and friendships I've ever had in my life. Definitely one of the most interesting men in the entire world. No one had the experiences that Wendell Stevens had. And so I know a lot of the UFO community feels the same way, that he was attacked. He was mercilessly attacked and tried to was defamed. They tried to entrap him. They tried to do all sorts of things to him. And he had that fighting spirit and never gave up. And even to the days right before his passing, he never gave up. And so I still admire Wendell Stevens after all these years. In almost every respect, I admire Wendell. There are, like I said, there are certain issues, and but as far as UFO research, there was none better, in my opinion.
Often the attacks are directly proportional to the amount of information you know and your ability to articulate that and publicly disseminate. Rick, in your Aztec UFO crash documentary, you detail the history from World War II and how the Nazis were known to have access to an advanced race and their technology. That technology, specifically their flying discs, were brought to the United States as part of Project Paperclip. I didn't realize that, but it's interesting if true and accurate. It infers then the crashed flying vehicles at that time period would have added to the Black Ops knowledge base here in the U.S., especially if crashed vehicle propulsion systems were more advanced than what the Germans had. What are your thoughts on this area of conjecture?
Jeff, some of this information is within my 6.5-hour documentary, S4 Informers series, on my YouTube channel, UFO Hypotheses. That's N-E-S-E-S. So one word, UFOHYPOTHESES. Sources of excellent information also include Wendell Stevens' books. For instance, his book, Nazi Flying Discs of the German V7 Weapons Development Program. He also did a documentary called The Nazi Discs, a DVD video documentary. There's a German version and an Australian version. There's the UFO contact at Aldebaran, which takes place in the northern area of Germany. He did a book called Hitler's Treasures of the Ancient World, where he talks about how Hitler never died and how Hitler had been taken to South America, put into position as a priest of a church, where they had gathered a lot of the treasures from the U-boats that brought them across from Germany during the fall of World War II for the German side, and all the stuff that they were stealing, art treasures and gold and stuff like that, were brought to South America, to Ecuador. So that's an interesting book. So, but that's not necessarily related to Aztec, but I thought I'd mention it. Then there's Joseph Farrell's books like Roswell and the Reich, The Nazi Connection. And the late Jim Nichols did a series of videos on this area of Nazi UFO research. And it's well visualized in his world-famous UFO paintings that a number of people have used for their productions over the years. And there's The Hunt for Zero Point by Nick Cook. That's considered a UFO classic. The star Aldebaran may play a role. Also, Tony Rodriguez's book, Ceres Colony Cavalier, shows where all this other research may have culminated decades later and up through the present day. And of course, there's Dr. Michael Sella, the world-renowned exopolitics specialist. He's got numerous books, videos, and interviews. He's always producing more every week. many of which listeners may find useful and exciting to learn about. And I would suggest listeners might also seek out the numerous books on Project Paperclip.
Great. Thank you for those references, Rick. I suspect many wonder how Nikola Tesla's work plugged into this technical movement brought by back-engineered non-human piloted vehicles. Have you found information related to this in your research?
So Tesla's a very big topic, kind of like Wendell Stevens, and deserves hours and hours of time. But Tesla was in contact with extraterrestrials, at least to my understanding. The area regarding Tesla that I feel is exceptionally intriguing to me and most ties into the World War II period is the Philadelphia experiment period of his life and his decision to withdraw from working with the U.S. Navy.
One theory for the multiple UFO crashes in southwestern U.S. is how the signature of a civilization reaching the advent of nuclear weapons testing, long-range missiles, and high-powered radar installations as a turning point by a more primitive civilization. They will either destroy themselves and leave the place for another species or continue to evolve. What are your thoughts on this well-known concept, and what needs to happen for humans to take back their evolutionary path?
Well, my personal feeling is that we need to understand that we, as a species, have been manipulated for thousands upon thousands of years by the various agendas of the malevolent ones, I would call them, watched and observed by neutral ETs, and assisted by benevolent beings of this and higher dimensions. Probably Earth has been associated with most all of the visiting extraterrestrial dimensional species that have been visiting, residing, and operating in this solar system for eons of time. Once we finally understand this fact, and that's taken a long time, but it will eventually happen, the 100th monkey effect will kick in at some point. Once we understand this fact, then we can begin to regain ourselves, our true benevolent nature, and begin to regain our sovereignty over our collective destiny as billions of people on one planet dedicated to life, liberty, kindness, and the pursuit of happiness and peace for all, and perhaps finally rise above the petty financial pursuits in favor of humanitarian pursuits. And that also includes far better treatment of the animals we share this planet with.
Rick Keefe, it really is an honor to have you on the show. You're a longtime UFO researcher. You're a journalist, a documentary filmmaker, and blog author. Your blog is UFOHypotheses.com. That's hypotheses plural. And Rick, would you tell listeners more about your healing?
Okay, well, I think maybe the best thing to do regarding all that, since I know you've got just a little bit of time left here, is that they can go to my WordPress page. I've had a good number of strange events occurring in my life and some extremely unusual events. And I have a blog detailing all that kind of activity called Diary of a Strange Lad. And the address of that is rickkeefe.wordpress.com. And so there's a good amount of material there that people can pore over if they want to get an idea of who I am as a human being and some of the types of things that have happened in my life personally.
Excellent. Rick Keefe, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Jeff, it's been a real pleasure. I hope this information gets spread far and wide. I know the Ramseys are certainly doing as much work as they can possibly do to help spread information about the Aztec case. Like I mentioned, Norio Hayakawa. There's other people that I can refer you to that you may want to bring on your show. And best of luck in the future, Jeff.
Excellent. Thank you so much.